Miss Karasef. Do stop by the Tepesar area. It's too hot to go in, but you've never seen anything like those specimens, I promise you. I nod, and he takes his leave. I remember where I've seen those eyes before, in pictures of the intellectual elite on Kaland. They take some kind of medicine designed to keep someone awake for longer than usual without suffering fatigue, and light-eyed people's irises often turn purple from prolonged use. That he's from Kaland doesn't tell me much about him. I've never been there, though I know the planet is wealthy and not particularly concerned about its oracles. But those eyes do. He's someone who values advancement over his own safety or vanity. He's focused and smart, and he probably thinks he knows better than the rest of us. I understand now what Issei meant when she said it was me, Ast, and her against the galaxy. It's not just the Shotet we're up against. It's the Assembly, too. Ast, Issei, and I sit on one side of a polished glass table, and the Assembly leader sits on the other. It's so clean that his water glass and the pitcher next to it almost look like they're floating. I rammed my legs against the edge when I sat down, because I wasn't sure where the table ended. If it's supposed to disarm me, it worked. "Let us first talk through what happened in Shotet," the Assembly leader says as he pours himself a glass of water. We're in the outer ring of the Assembly ship, which is arranged in concentric circles. All the outer walls are made of glass that turns opaque when the ship rotates to face the sun, so nobody's corneas get burned. The walls to my left are opaque now, and the room is heating up, so there's a ring of sweat around my collar. Ast keeps pinching the front of his shirt and pulling it away from his body to keep it from sticking. I am sure the footage the sites provided is more than sufficient, Issei says, clipped. She's wearing Chancellor clothes, a heavy Thuvazit dress, long-sleeved, buttoned up to her throat. Tight boots that made her grimace while she laced them. Her hair is pinned to the back of her head and shines like she lacquered it there. If she's hot, which she must be, that dress is made for Thuva, not this. She doesn't show it. Maybe that's why she put such a dense layer of powder on her skin before we left.
I understand your reticence to discuss it, the Assembly leader says. Perhaps Miss Karasith can give us a summary instead. She was there too, correct?
Issei glances at me. I fold my hands in my lap and smile, remembering that the Assembly leader's preferred texture was a warm breeze. That's how I need to be, too. All warm and casual, a layer of sweat you don't mind, a gust of air that almost tickles. Of course, I say. Syra Noavec challenged her brother, Rizek, to a duel, and he accepted. But before either of them could hit each other, my brother, Ija, appeared. I choke. I can't say the rest. Sorry, I say. My current gift isn't being cooperative. She can't always say what she wants to say, Issei clarifies. Which is that Ija was holding a knife to my sister's throat. He killed her. The end.
And Rizek?
Also killed, Issei says. And for a tick, I think she's going to tell him what she did on the ship. How she went into the storage room with a knife and teased a confession out of him and then stuck him with the blade like it was a stinger. But then she adds, by his own sister, who then dragged the body aboard, I assume to keep it from being defiled by the mob that had erupted into chaos.
And now, his body is...
drifting through space, I assume, Issei says. That is the preferred Shotet method of burial, no? I don't familiarize myself with Shotet customs, the assembly leader says, leaning back in his chair. Very well. That is all as I expected. As far as how the rest of the galaxy has responded, well, I have been fielding messages from the other leaders and representatives since your sister's death was broadcast. They have interpreted the killing as an act of war and wish to know how we will proceed from here.
Issei laughs. It's the same bitter laugh she gave Rizek before she cut him open.
We? She says. Two seasons ago, I asked for support from the Assembly to declare war on Shotet in light of the killing of our falling oracle. And I was told that the civil dispute between Shotet and Thuva, as you have termed it, is an intraplanetary matter. That I needed to handle it internally. And now you're wondering what we will be doing? There is no we, Assembly Leader.
The Assembly Leader looks to me, eyebrows raised. If he expects me to, what word did he use? Soothe her? He's going to be disappointed. I don't always get to control my current gift, but I don't want to do something just because he says so. I'm not sure yet whether there's any advantage to Issei being soothed.
2 seasons ago, Rizek Noavek didn't kill a chancellor's sister, the assembly leader replies, all smooth and level. Shotet was not in a state of total upheaval. The situation has changed.
The opaque panels on the left side of the chamber are starting to lighten up again, turning from wall to window.
Do you know how long they've been attacking us? Issei says. Since before I was born. Over 20 seasons.
I am aware of the history of conflict between Thuva and Shotet.
So what was your thought process then? Issei says. That we're just a bunch of thick-headed ice flower farmers? So who cares if we get attacked as long as the product is safe?
She laughs harshly.
The town of Hessa is decimated by guerrilla warfare, and you call it a civil dispute. My face gets carved up and my parents get killed, and no one budges an inch except to send condolences. One of my oracles dies, and another is kidnapped, and it's my job to handle it. So why are you all hopping with excitement to help me now? What has everyone scared?
His eye twitches a little.
You must understand that to the rest of the galaxy, the Shotet were little more than an annoyance until the Noavex came into power, he says. When you came to us 2 seasons ago, describing vicious warriors, we thought of the sad Rex who once came begging at another planet's doorstep every season to dig through our trash.
They've been looting hospitals and attacking fueling outposts for longer than 2 seasons on their sojourns, she replies. This escaped the attention of every single planet's leadership until now?
Not precisely, the assembly leader says. But we received information from a credible source that Lazmet Noavek is still alive, and will soon move to reclaim his place at Shotet's helm. You have not been alive long enough to truly grasp this, but Rizek was remarkably civil compared to his father. He inherited his mother's desire for diplomacy, if not her ease with it. It was under Lazmet that Shotet became fearsome. It was still under his guidance, from beyond the grave apparently, that Rizek pursued oracles and, indeed, your sister at all.
So you're all afraid of him, this one man?
Asked Frowns.
What can he do? Shoot fire out of his ass?
Lazmet controls people, quite literally, using his current gift. the assembly leader says. His abilities, combined with the new strength of the Shotet fighting force, are not to be underestimated. We must treat the Shotet as an infestation, a blight on land that could otherwise be used for ice flower farming, for something useful and valuable. His eyes glitter. I may not have grown up fancy, but I know how to speak subtext. He wants the Shotet gone. At one point, they were a husk of a people, clanking around the galaxy in their big, outdated ship, starved and sick and sagging. He wants that back. He wants more ice flowers. More valuable Thuvazit land. More for him, and nothing for them. And he wants to use Issei to get it. Mom used to tell me that all the galaxy once mocked the Shotet. Dirty scavengers, they called them, and fleshworms. They flew in circles around the solar system, chasing their own tails. Half the time they didn't even sound like they were saying words. I knew all this. I'd heard it, even said some of it myself. But the assembly leader isn't just mocking the Shotet now. Then tell me, Issei says, what disciplinary action the assembly has planned for the Pithar, given that the Pithar leadership suggested it might be amenable to a trade agreement with Shotet not long ago.
Don't play the fool with me, Chancellor, the assembly leader says, but not like he's mad, more like he's tired. You know that we can't act against Pitha. The galaxy cannot function without the materials Pitha provides.
I'd never given Pitha much thought before. I'd actually never thought about politics, period, until I fell back in with the Benazit sisters after my dad died. But the assembly leader is right. Durable materials from Pitha make up almost all the good tech in the galaxy, including ships. And in Thuva, especially, with our frozen air, we rely on insulated Pithar glass for our windows. We can't afford to lose them any more than the rest of the Assembly of Nine Planets can.
Pitha has retracted their willingness to engage with Shotet, and that will have to be enough. As for the rest of the nation planets, they still believe the war effort should be headed up by Thuva, given that it is an intraplanetary matter. They are open to discussions about aid and support, however.
So, in other words, Ast says, you'll throw money at her, but she still has to give you a wall of flesh between Shotet and the rest of you.
My, you certainly do enjoy dramatic language, don't you, Mr.?
The assembly leader tilts his head.
Do you have a surname?
I don't need any kind of honorific, Ast says. Call me Ast, or don't call me anything.
Ast,
the assembly leader says, and he softens his voice like he's talking to a child.
Money is not the only form of aid the assembly can offer. And if war is what confronts you, Miss Benazit, you are in no position to refuse our help.
Maybe I don't want to fight a war, she says, sitting back in her chair. Maybe I want to broker a peace.
That is, of course, your prerogative,
the assembly leader replies.
However, I will be forced to pursue an investigation I had hoped I would be able to avoid.
An investigation into what? Issei scowls.
It would be quite simple for a person to consult the heat signatures in the Voa amphitheater at the time of Rizek's alleged death. And if a person did, they might see that Rizek was alive when he was taken aboard that transport ship,
the assembly leader says,
which means that if his body is adrift in space, as you say, someone else must have killed him. Not Syra Novavec.
Interesting theory, Issei says.
I can't think of why you would lie to me and tell me Syra Novak committed the crime in the arena, unless you needed to protect yourself, Miss Benazit, the assembly leader says. And if you were to be investigated for murder, particularly premeditated murder against a self-declared sovereign, then you would not be permitted to rule Thuva until you were acquitted.
So, just to clarify, asked Sez, glowering, you are threatening to tie Issei up in bureaucratic nonsense if she doesn't do as you say.
The assembly leader only smiles.
If you would like me to proofread your declaration of war before you send it to the Shotet, I will happily take a look at it, he says. I must now take my leave. Good day, Miss Benazit, Miss Kariseth. Asked.
His head bobs three times, once for each of us, and then he's gone. I glance at Issei. Would he really do that? I say. Charge you with murder? I don't doubt it. Her mouth puckers. Let's go.
Chapter 9. Syra.
Syra?
Tekka raised an eyebrow at me outside the ship's little bathroom when I got up for my shift. I was dressed only in underwear and my sweater from the day before. I avoided her eyes as I searched the ship's storage room for a spare mechanic's uniform. We were all running out of clothes. Hopefully they would provide for us on Agra. Tekka cleared her throat. She was leaning against the wall, arms folded, a plain black eye patch covering her missing eye.
I don't have to worry about little Kariseth Noavek's spawn running around someday, do I?
She yawned.
Because I really don't want to.
No, I said with a snort. Like I'd take that risk.
Never?
She frowned a little.
There's this thing called contraception, you know.
I shook my head. Nothing is certain. The little mocking expression she always wore when she was looking at me faded, leaving her serious. My current gift, I explained, holding up a hand to show her the shadows that curled around my knuckles, stinging me, is an instrument of torture. You think I would risk inflicting that torture on something growing inside me? Even if it's a very limited risk? I shook my head. No. She nodded.
That's very decent of you.
I added, it's not like that is the only thing you can do with someone anyway. She brought her hands up to her face, groaning.
I did not want any information that specific, she said, voice muffled.
Then don't ask probing questions, genius. I found a mechanic's jumpsuit buried under a stack of towels and stood to hold it up to my body. The legs were too long, so I would have to roll them, but it would have to do. I dove back into the pile to look for underwear. How long until we get to Agra? I said. Because we're going to run out of food pretty soon, you know.
Food and toilet paper. The recycled water is starting to smell weird, too,
Tekka agreed.
I think we'll make it, without too much snacking. A few days.
This ship's upgrades are pretty brilliant, I said. I found a pair of too big underwear wedged into a corner of one of the shelves, and clutched the ball of clothes to my chest as pain burned across my back. You did them all?
Jorik helped, she said.
Her face fell a little.
Not sure where he is right now. He was supposed to send a message from Voa once he made sure his mother was safe.
I didn't know Jorik well, just that he was a more virtuous soul than his father had been and was, apparently, a renegade. so I didn't try to reassure her. My words would have been empty. "We'll find out about a lot of things when we get to Agra," I said. "Jorik's status among them."
"Yeah," Tekka shrugged. "Get to the nav deck, Noavek. Your break is over."
The next few days passed in a haze. I spent most of the time sleeping, tucked in the galley near the sink, or sitting up in the first officer's chair while Akos took his shift. Our surroundings seemed designed to drive us all mad. They yielded so little of interest. The sky was dark, and without stars, planets, or drifting ships to break it up, completely flat. I often had to check the nav map to make sure we hadn't stalled. I shared most of my waking time, when not in the captain's chair, with Tekka, trying to distract myself from my current gift. She taught me a game she usually played with multicolored stones, though we used handfuls of beans from the galley and drew dots on them to tell them apart. We spent most of the time arguing over which beans were which, but I came to see that bickering was a sign of friendship with Tekka, and mostly didn't mind it, as long as no one stormed out. Akos sometimes joined us before going to sleep, sitting too close to me and tucking his nose into my hair when he thought Tekka wouldn't notice. She always did. My nights I spent huddled together with Akos when I could, and finding new places to kiss. Our first fumbles at intimacy had been full of awkward laughter and uncomfortable squirming. I was learning to touch another person, as well as to touch him in particular, and it was difficult to learn everything at once. But we were both happy to practice. Despite his constant nightmares, he didn't wake screaming, but he often woke with a start, a sheen of sweat on his brow. And my lingering grief for the brother who had been twisted into a monster. We found snatches of happiness together, built largely on ignoring everything around us. It worked well. It worked well, that was, until Agra came into view.
"Why?"
Tekka said, staring at the black hole of a planet we were headed toward.
"Would anyone ever settle here?"
Akos laughed.
"You could say the same about Thuva."
"Don't call it that when we land," I said, cocking an eyebrow. "It's Urek or nothing."
"Right."
Urek meant empty, but said with reverence, not like an insult. Empty, to us, meant possibility. It meant freedom. Agra had come into sight as a small, dark gap in the stars ahead, and then the gap had turned into a hole, like a stray ember burned through fabric. And now it loomed darkly above the nav deck, devouring every fragment of light in its vicinity. I wondered how the first settlers had even known it was a planet. It looked more like a yawn.
"I take it it's not an easy landing," Akos said.
"No,"
Tekka laughed.
"No, it's not. The only way to get through it without getting ripped to shreds is to completely disable the ship's power and freefall. Then I have to reactivate the ship's power before we all liquefy on impact."
She brought her hands together with a smack.
"So we all need to strap in and say a prayer, or whatever makes you feel lucky."
Akos looked paler than usual. I laughed. Sifa came up behind us, clutching a book to her stomach. There were few books aboard the ship. What use would they have had? But those she had been able to rummage, she had brought to Aija one by one, along with his food. Akos didn't ask about him, and neither did I. I assumed his status was unchanged, and that the worst parts of my brother lived on in him. I needed no further updates.
"Luck," Sifa said,
is simply a construct to make people believe they are in control of some aspect of their destinies.
Tekka appeared to consider this, but Akos just rolled his eyes.
Or maybe it's just a word for what fate looks like to the rest of us, I said to her. I was the only one willing to argue with Sifa.
Tekka was too reverent, and Akos too dismissive.
You've forgotten what it's like to stare at the future from this angle instead of your own.
Sifa smirked at me. She smirked at me often.
Perhaps you are correct.
Everybody strap in, Tekka said. Oracle, I need you in the first officer's chair. You know the most about flying.
Hey,
I said.
Current gifts go haywire on Agra, Tekka said to me. We're not sure how yours will do, so you sit in the back. Keep the Karaseth boys in line.
Sifa had escorted Aija to a landing seat already. He was strapped in and staring at the floor. I sighed and made my way down to the main deck. Akos and I sat across from Aija, and I pulled the straps across my chest and lap. Akos fumbled with his own, but I didn't help him. He knew how to do it. He just needed to practice. I watched Tekka and Sifa as they prepared for landing, poking buttons and flicking switches. It seemed routine for Tekka. That was reassuring, at least. I didn't want to free fall through a hostile atmosphere with a captain who was panicking.
Here we go,
Tekka shouted, and with only that warning, all the lights in the ship switched off. The engine stopped its whirring and humming. Dark atmosphere struck the nav window like a wave of Pithar rain, and for a few long moments I couldn't see anything, couldn't feel anything. I wanted to scream. Agra's gravity caught us, and it was worse, much worse than feeling nothing. My stomach and my body felt suddenly separate, one floating up and the other pulling hard to the ground. The craft shuddered, metal plates squeaking against their screws, the steps to the nav deck rattling. My teeth clacked together. It was still too dark to see anything, even the current shadows that twisted around my arms. Next to me, Akos let out a litany of curses under his breath, in three languages. I couldn't speak. My flesh weighed too heavily on my bones. A slamming sound, then, and the engine whirred again. Before the lights turned on, though, the planet lit up beneath us. It was still dark. Neither sun nor current stream could possibly penetrate Agra's atmosphere. But it was dotted with light, veined with it. The ship's control panel glowed, and the horrible, heavy falling sensation disappeared as the ship moved forward instead of down, down, down. And then, hot and sharp and strong, pain.
Chapter 10. Akos. Syro was screaming. Akos's hands were shaking from the landing, but still undoing the straps that held him in place, almost without his permission. Right when Akos was free, he launched himself from his seat and slid to his knees in front of Syra. The shadows had pulled away from her body in a dark cloud, the same way they had when Voss forced her to touch him, down in the amphitheater's prison where she had almost lost her life. Her hands were buried in her hair, clenched. She looked up at him, and a strange smile twisted her face. He put his hands on hers. The shadows looked like smoke in the air, but they pulled back into Syra's body like dozens of strings yanked at once. Syra's odd smile was gone, and she was staring at their joined hands. "What will happen when you let go?" she said quietly. "You'll be just fine," he said. "You'll learn to control it. You can do that now, remember?" She let out an airy laugh. "I can hang on as long as you like," he said. her eyes hardened. When she spoke, it was with gritted teeth. Let go. Akos couldn't help but think back to something he'd read in one of the books Syra had put in his room on the Sojourn ship. He'd had to read it through a translator because it was written in Xotet, and it had been called Tenets of Xotet Culture and Belief. It said the most marked characteristic of the Xotet people is directly translated as armored, but outsiders might call it metal. It refers not to courageous acts in difficult situations, though the Xotet certainly hold valor in high regard, but to an inherent quality that cannot be learned or imitated. It is in the blood as surely as their revelatory language. Metal is bearing up again and again under assaults. It is perseverance, acceptance of risk, and the unwillingness to surrender. That paragraph had never made more sense to him than it did right now. Akos obeyed. At first, when the current shadows reappeared, they formed the smoky cloud around her body again, but Syra set her jaw. "Can't meet the Augurans with a death cloud around me," she said. Her eyes held his as she breathed deeply. The shadows began to worm their way beneath her skin, traveling down her fingers, wriggling up her throat. She screamed again, right into her teeth, half a dozen izzets from his face. But then the breath hissed out, same as it had come in, and she straightened. The cloud was gone. "They're back to how they were before," he said to her. "Like they were when I met you." "Yeah," she said. "It's this planet. My gift is stronger here." "You've been here before?" She shook her head. "No, but I can feel it." "Do you need a painkiller?" he said. Another head shake. "Not yet. I have to readjust sometime. May as well be now." Tekka was talking on the nav deck in Otherian. "Ship ID Renegade Transport, Captain Sarukta requesting permission to land. Captain Sarukta, permission granted to landing area 32. Congratulations on your safe arrival," a voice responded over the intercom. Tekka snorted as she switched off the communicator. "I bet that's standard practice, congratulating people on surviving." "I've been here before," Sifa said, wry. "It is indeed standard practice." Tekka guided them to landing area 32, somewhere between the veins of light that had greeted them once they passed the atmosphere. Akos felt a bump as they touched down, and then they were there, on a new planet, on Agra. Agra was a mystery to most of the galaxy. It had become the subject of a lot of rumors, from as silly as Augurans live in holes underground, to as dangerous as Augurans are shielding their own atmosphere so we won't find out they're making deadly weapons. So when Akos stepped out of the ship, he didn't know what would greet him, if anything. For all he knew, Agra was barren. His hold on Syra's hand loosened as he paused at the bottom of the steps to stare. They were in a city of sorts, but it was like no city he'd ever seen. Small buildings, glowing with green and blue lights of all shapes and sizes, rose up all around them, dark shapes against a dark sky. Growing around and between them were trees without leaves to absorb the sun. Their branches twisted around pillars, folding whole towers into their arms. The trees were tall, too, taller than anything else around, and the contrast of the clean lines of buildings and the organic curves of growing things was strange to him. The glowing, though, that was even stranger. Faint dots wove through the air that he recognized as insects. Panels of light show dim impressions of the insides of houses. And in the narrow channels of water that replaced some of the streets, there were streaks of color like poured dye, and the flash of movement as some creature made its way along. "Welcome to Agra," an accented voice said from some place up ahead. Akos could only see the man by the white orb that hovered around his face. As he spoke, in competent Shotet no less, the orb attached to his chest, right under his chin, and lit his face from beneath. He was middle-aged, lined with stark white hair that curled around his ears. "If you'll form a short line, we can note your presence here and then escort you to the Shotet sector," he said. "We have only an hour before the storms begin." "The storms?" Akos raised an eyebrow at Syra, and she shrugged. She didn't seem to know any more than he did. Tekka was first in line, reporting her surname with a brisk tone that read as businesslike. "Sarukta," the man repeated as he typed her name into the small device in his hand. "I knew your mother. I was sad to hear of her passing." Tekka mumbled her way through something, maybe gratitude, though it didn't sound like it. Then it was Syra's turn. "Syra," she said. "Noavik." The man paused with his fingers over the keys. He looked menacing with that white light glowing under his face, casting shadows that filled his eye sockets and the deepest creases of his face. She stared back, letting him look her over, from silver skin to armored wrist to worn boots. But he didn't say anything, just typed her name into his device and waved her past. She kept her hand in Akos's, her arm stretched out behind her until he too was waved along. Tekka tripped over to them, her eyes wide and shining. "Amazing, right?" she said, smiling. "I always wanted to see it." "You've never come before," Syra said. "Not even to see your mother?" "No, I was never allowed to visit her." There was an edge to her voice. "It wasn't safe. The exile colony has been here for over 2 generations, though, ever since the Noaveks came into power. And the Ogryns just let you stay here," Akos said. "They say anyone who can survive this planet has a right to be here," Tekka said. "It doesn't look as dangerous as I was expecting," Syra said. "Everyone always talks about how hard it is to survive here, but it seems peaceful enough." "Don't let it fool you," Tekka said. "Everything here is ready to attack or defend. The plants, the animals, even the planet itself. They can't eat sun, so they eat each other instead. Or you." "The plants are carnivorous," Akos said. "From what I know," she shrugged. "Or they eat the current, which probably explains why they've been able to survive here. If there's anything Agra has a lot of, it's the current." She smiled with some mischief. And as if the constant threat of being devoured wasn't enough, "Well, let's just say he's not talking about a little awakening shower when he says storms." "Cryptic, aren't you?" Syra said, frowning. "Yes," she grinned. "It's nice to have the upper hand for once. Come on." Tekka led them to one of the canals. They had to go down some steps to get to the water's edge. They were cracked from the tree roots and uneven. Akos reached down to run his hand over the persistent roots, which were covered in fine, dark fuzz. There were plants here. He hadn't thought about foreign plant species on Pitha, mostly because there were no plants to be found on Pitha, at least not where he could reach them. But Agra was thick with trees. He wondered with a thrill of excitement what you could make with the plants here. A boat waited at the edge of the canal, long and narrow, with room for only 4 people across each row of benches. Akos guessed by its glint that it was made of metal. It was dark except for the glow of the water beneath it, a streak of rosy pink. "What's that light?" he asked Tekka. But Tekka wasn't the one who answered. It was the woman stationed at the front of the boat, her dark eyes lined with white paint. At first he thought maybe there was a practical reason for the paint, but the longer he looked at her, the more it seemed just decorative, like the black lines people smudged near their eyelashes at home. Here, white just showed up better. "There are many strains of bacteria that live in Agra's waters," she said. "They light up in different colors. Let them remind you that only our darkest water is safe to drink. Even the water could defend itself on Agra." Akos walked the unsteady plank that connected shore to boat and stepped on one bench to get to another. Cyrus settled herself next to him, and he put his hand on her wrist, where the armor ended. He squeezed and leaned over the edge of the boat to look at the water. The streaks of pink were moving, lazy with the current of the water. He tried not to think about Sifa and Aija settling in behind them. Sifa's eyes watchful so his own didn't have to be. But the boat dipped with their weight, and his stomach sank, too. He couldn't avoid Aija on Agra like he had on the ship. They were going to be stuck together. The Thuvazits among Shotet among Agrans. The woman at the front sat, taking into her hands huge oars that dangled on either side of the vessel. With a sharp yank, she drove them forward, her face showing no effort. She was strong. "A useful current gift," Syra commented. "It comes in handy every now and then. Most of the time I am called upon to open stubborn jars," the woman said, as she found a rhythm in her rowing. The ship cut through the water like a hot knife through butter. "Don't put your hands in the water, by the way." "Why not?" Cyrus said. She just laughed. Akos kept looking over the side, at the changing colors beneath the water's surface. The pink glow clung to the shallows, near the edge of the canal. Where it was deeper, there were specks of blue, wisps of purple, and wells of deep red. "There," the Agran woman said, and he followed the tilt of her head to a massive shape in the canal. At first he thought it was just more of the bacteria finding the current. But as they slid past it, he saw it was a creature, twice as wide as their narrow boat and twice again as long. It had a bulbous head, or he assumed it was a head, and at least a dozen tentacles that tapered to feathery ends. He was able to see it only because of how the bacteria clung to it, like paint streaking its smooth sides. It turned, tentacles twisting together like rope, and on its flank he saw a mouth as big as his own torso, framed all around by sharp, narrow teeth. He stiffened. "The undersides of these boats are made of a current shielding material we call soju," the Agran woman said. "The animal, a galansk, is drawn to the current to devour it. If you put your hand in the water, it would be drawn to you, but it can't sense us in this boat." And true to her word, with the next pull of her oars, the galansk turned again and dove deep, becoming just a faint glow under the surface of the water. A moment later, it was gone. "You mine this metal here?" Tekka asked the woman. "No, no. There's nothing on this planet that is not current rich," the woman said. "We import soju from Asander." "Why do you live on a planet so determined to kill you?" he said. The Agran woman smiled at him. "I could ask the Shotet the same question." "I'm not Shotet," he said. "Are you not?" she said with a shrug and continued to row. His back ached by the time they got to their destination. from the stress of the landing followed by sitting on the uncomfortable bench in the boat. The Ogryn woman steered them toward the edge of the canal, where there were stone steps overrun with the same velvet-soft wood he had touched earlier. Next to the steps was the yawn of a tunnel. "We must go underground to avoid the storms," she said. "You can explore the Shotet sector another time." The storms. She said it reverently, but not fondly. It was something she feared, this woman with the strength of half a dozen people, and that made Akos fear it too. He climbed out of the boat on unsteady legs, relieved to find solid ground. He reached back to help Syra, his mouth drawn into a thin line. "I thought the Shotet were fierce," he said, "but the people here must be downright lethal." "A different kind of ferocity, perhaps," she said. "They don't hesitate, but they fight without finesse. It's a kind of clumsy courage. And a kind of madness, too, to live in a place like this." Akos knew, listening to her, that she had spent more time observing the Ogryns than she would ever admit to. That she didn't even realize there was anything to admit to, because she assumed all other people were as inquisitive as she was. She had likely watched every piece of footage of Ogryn combat she could get her hands on, and a half a dozen other subjects besides. All those files were stored in her quarters on the Sojourn ship, her little den of knowledge. They walked into the tunnel, led at first by the Ogryn woman's whistling alone. But 10 paces in, Akos saw light. Some of the stones in the walls of the tunnel were glowing. They were small, smaller than his fist, and set at random into the walls and ceiling. The woman whistled louder, and the stones grew brighter. Akos pursed his lips, hiding his face as he tried a whistle of his own. The light in the stones near him went white, with the warmth of sunlight. Was this as close to sunlight as Agra ever got? He glanced at Syra. She winced, the current shadows lively across the back of her neck, but she was smiling at him. "What?" he said. "You're excited," she said. "This planet is probably going to kill us, and you love it." "Well," he said, feeling defensive, "it's fascinating, that's all." "I know," she said. "It's just, I don't expect other people to love the odd and dangerous things I love." She draped her arm around his waist, her touch light so he didn't feel her weight. He leaned into her, slinging his own arm over her shoulders. Her skin went blank again at his touch. Then he heard it. The low rumble, like the planet itself was growling, and at this point he wouldn't have been surprised to hear that it was. "Come along, ice dwellers," the Ogryn woman sang, her voice ringing. She reached down and stuck her pinky through something, a metal loop in the dark floor. With a flick of her wrist, a trap door pulled up from the ground, scattering dust. Akka spotted narrow stairs that disappeared into nothingness. Well, he thought, time to summon some Shotet metal.
Chapter 11. Syra. The last time I had walked into a crowd, it was to pretend to kill my own brother, and they had thirsted for my blood. And before that, he had carved my skin from my head to the tune of hundreds of cheers. I reached up to touch the silver skin that covered me from throat to jaw to skull. No, I did not have pleasant memories of crowds, and I was not likely to form them here, with only Ogryns and Shotet exiles waiting for me. We had walked down the dark stairs, feeling our way with the soles of our shoes and the brushes of our fingers, and turned a sharp corner, and here we were, in a dim waiting space with creaky wood floors, and the glow of Ogryn clothing, most of which adorned Shotet bodies, though I only knew because of the language they spoke. Ogryn clothing, which even the Shotet wore here, had no real distinct style, some of it tight and some flowing, some ornate and some simple, but the embrace of that ever-present glow was there, in bracelets and anklets and necklaces, shoelaces and belts and buttons. One man I passed even had stripes of red light, faint but still light, stitched into the back of his jacket. It gave everyone an eerie look, lit from beneath by their garments, their faces difficult to see. Those with fair skin, like Akos's, almost gave off their own light. Not an advantage on a planet as hostile as this. There were benches for sitting, and high tables for standing around. Some held glasses with a clear substance that scattered light inside them. I watched a bottle passed through a group of people, bobbing along like their hands were waves. Children sat in a circle near my feet, playing a game with quick hand motions passed in a round. Two boys, a few seasons younger than me, play-fought near one of the massive room's wooden pillars. This was a space for gathering, and, I sensed, not much else. This was not where the Shotet lived or worked or ate, but just a space to wait out the storms. The Ogryn woman had remained vague about what the storms actually were. Not surprising. Ogryns seemed to trade in vague language and weighty looks. Tekka melded into the crowd right away, throwing her arms around the nearest exile she recognized. That was when people began to take notice of us. Tekka, with her pale skin and even paler hair, required no introduction. Akos was a head taller than most people in the room, and drew eyes naturally. And then there was me, glinting silver skin and current shadows crawling all over my body. I tried not to tense as some people went quiet at the sight of me, and others muttered, or pointed. Who had taught them manners? I was used to this sort of reaction, I reminded myself. I was Syra Noavec. Guards at the manor backed away from me instinctively. Women held their children near at the sight of me. I drew myself up straighter, taller, and shook my head when Akos reached for me to help me with my pain. No, better to let them see me as I was. Better to get this over with. I pretended I was not breathing harder. Hey! Tekka pinched the elbow of my oddly sized mechanic's jumpsuit and tugged. Come on, we should introduce ourselves to the leadership. You don't know them already? I said, as Akos searched behind him, for his mother and brother, I assumed, though he had been avoiding them since we landed. I tried to imagine how I would have acted if my mother had returned to my life after I had accepted that I would never see her again. In my mind, it was a happy reunion, and we fell into our old rhythms of care and understanding. It certainly wasn't that simple for Akos, with the history of betrayal and subterfuge that existed between him and Sifa. But even without that, perhaps it was never simple. Perhaps I would have avoided Illyra just as he avoided his mother. Or maybe it was just that she spoke in riddles, and it was exhausting. Once Akos had rounded up his family, we all followed Tekka deeper into the room. I tried to keep myself from marching, though that was my instinct, scare them on purpose, so I didn't have to watch them grow frightened by accident.
So we're right near the village of Gallo, Tekka said. It's mostly full of Shotet exiles now, but there are still some Ogryns who live here, merchants mostly. My mother said we'd integrated pretty well. Oh!
Tekka threw her arms around a pale-haired man with a mug in hand, then shook hands with a woman with a shaved head, who tapped Tekka's eye patch in gentle mocking.
I'm saving my fancy one for a special occasion, Tekka replied. Do you know where Etrek is?
I have to introduce him to... Ah. A man had stepped forward, tall, though not as tall as Akko's, with long, dark hair drawn up into a knot. I couldn't decide, in this light, if he was my age or 10 seasons older. The rumble in his voice didn't do much to help.
Ah, here she is, the man said. Rizek's scourge turned Rizek's executioner.
He put an arm around me, turning as if to draw me into a group of people all holding glasses of whatever it was. I pulled away from him so quickly he might not have had the chance to feel my current gift. Pain darted across my cheek and followed my next swallow down my throat. Call me that again and I will—
What? Hurt me? The man smirked. It would be interesting to see you try. Then we would see if you are as good at fighting as they say.
Regardless of whether I am a good fighter or not, I snapped. I am not Rizek's executioner. So humble, an older woman across from me said, tipping some of her drink into her mouth. We all saw what you did on the news feed, Miss Novak. There's no need to be shy about it. I am neither shy nor humble, I said, feeling my mouth twist into my sourest smile. My head was pounding. I just don't believe everything I see. You should have learned that lesson well enough, exile. I almost laughed, seeing all their eyebrows pop up in unison. Akos touched my shoulder, the part covered with fabric, and bent closer to my ear. Slow down on making enemies, he said. There's plenty of time for that later. I stifled a laugh. He had a point, though. At first, all I saw next was a broad smile in the dark, and then Jorik collided with Akos. Akos looked too confused to return the embrace. Actually, he didn't seem particularly affectionate as a rule, I had noticed. But he managed to give Jorik a good-natured slap on the shoulder as he pulled away. Took you long enough to get here, Jorik said. I was beginning to think you guys got kidnapped by the Chancellor. No, Akos said. Actually, we abandoned her in an escape pod. Really? Jorek's eyebrows popped up. That's sort of a shame. I liked her. You liked her? I said. Miss Novak, Jorik said, bobbing his head to me. He turned back to Akos. Yeah, she was a little scary, and apparently I gravitate toward that quality in friends. My cheeks warmed as he looked from Akos to me and back again, pointedly. Jorik thought of me as a friend? How's your mom? Akos said to him. Is she here? Jorik had stayed behind after our little mission to ensure that his mother made it through the chaos of Voa. Safe and sound, but no, she's not here, Jorik said. She said if she ever manages to land on Agra, she's never going to try to take off again. No, she's keeping an eye on things for us in Voa. Moved in with her brother and his children. Good, Akos said. He scratched the back of his neck, and his fingertips scraped along the thin chain he wore, the one with the ring R.A. Kuzar had given him hanging from the end of it. He didn't wear it out of affection, as R.A. and Jorik had undoubtedly hoped he would, but as a burden, a reminder. Tekka had disappeared for a moment, but she returned now with a sturdy woman at her side. She was not tall or short, really, and her hair was pulled back into a tight braid. The smile she gave me was warm enough, though, like the others, she didn't even glance in Akos's direction. Her attention was solely mine. Miss Novak, the woman said, offering her hand. I am Aza. I sit on our council here. I glanced at Akos, asking a silent question. He rested his hand on the bare skin where my neck met my shoulder, extinguishing my current shadows. I knew without trying that I was not capable of controlling my gift right now,
as I had learned to in the renegade hideout in Voa. Not in Agra's current gift-enhancing atmosphere, with days of limited sleep behind me. It was taking all the energy I had just to keep it contained, so